Brother Richard Perkins, with the third talk in the series In the Wilderness. This morning, the power to pardon. The reading today comes from one of those marvelous psalms that meditate on the significance of the wilderness journey. Psalm 78. We're going to start at verse 14 and read as far as verse 42. It's a marvellous psalm, isn't it? You know, we British people tend to be a little afraid of poetry. We misunderstand it. Poetry is the most precise use of language. It's telegraphic language, so that every word has within it a whole series of concepts, and it needs searching out. And this grand poetry of the Psalms opens up so much of the inner meaning of the wilderness journey. Let's just take two points from this psalm before we have a look at the first couple of stopping places and learn some lessons from them once they left Sinai. Firstly, we have this verse 37 of Psalm 78, which bears very directly on what we've been discussing from Romans this week. Their heart was not right with him. Neither were they steadfast in his covenant. And this is precisely what we shall find when we begin the journey with them now. That these two things are interrelated, and they are for us as well, brethren and sisters. When our heart goes after and lusts after other things, and I suppose one of the two sins that Christadelphians are allowed are gluttony and classical music. just notice in passing, brethren and sisters, that a little piece of additional information to Numbers is given in verse 31, that in this matter of the quails, the wrath of God came upon them and slew the fattest of them. So that's one in the eye for us, you know. However, let's remember that when our heart goes after other things, when our heart is not right with, here's this concept of rightness with God, this relationship with God, it is because we are not steadfast in his covenant. You see, the things are absolutely interrelated. Putting it in extreme terms so that we can see the implication, the intellectual understanding of the truth, which itself is a gift, otherwise we wouldn't have been given the truth in words that exercise our minds that God has given us, must be related to a reaction within the heart, which is the seat of understanding and not of intellectual knowledge, as it were. These two things must be bound together. So that was the first point to take out of these verses to prepare us for what we're about to do, that it was because their heart was not right and because they weren't steadfast in the covenant. And we shall see illustrations of this. And then the following verse, so wonderful. He, being full of compassion, forgave, destroyed them not, did not stir up all his wrath. Right, well, let's follow up those ideas now and turn to Numbers chapter 10 and begin the journey. Now, you may feel that we've taken a long time getting started. But this is because we're looking at themes from the book of Numbers. We are not attempting an exposition of the book. And we've seen that the Lord made his own preparations. He remembered his covenant. He was steadfast to his covenant. He made promises. And when Moses prayed, when, as it is about to do, the camp was struck and the ecclesia of God moved forward into the wilderness, he could say, "Rise up, establish this covenant of yours, and let your enemies be scattered." And secondly, we've looked at this theme that is absolutely essential for our preparation for getting lessons from this book, the theme of holiness, holiness that demands this awareness of the sanctity of God, of his very separateness, so that our lives move towards him and his thinking, and we can go from this conference and be the better preachers, because that is what holiness is: sharing what we have found. Well, chapter 10 begins with the making of the two trumpets, the silver trumpets for the two sons of Aaron, Eleazar and Ithamar, who are to be the heralds, as it were, for the movement of the camp. And in verse 11, it came to pass on the 20th day of the second month, in the second year, that the cloud was taken up from off the tabernacle of testimony. And that was a signal, wasn't it? When the cloud moved, then they moved. We're then given the order in which the camp moved, and if you'd like to look at page 1 of the now familiar chart, you will notice that there are a series of fairly bold numbers next to the four major tribes and to the subsections of the Levite house, so that on the extreme right, to the right of the word Judah, we have the figure 1. And then, between the two Levite families of Merari, north of the tabernacle, and Gershon on the west, we have the figure 2. Now, those numbers represent the order of the marching of the camp, as in verses 14 and onwards of chapter 10. Judah and the two tribes, Issachar and Zebulun, moved off first. Then, for a very simple and a very sound reason, the Levites, who were responsible for the fabric, the curtains, the boards, the pillars, the sockets, and so on, put the apparatus onto the six covered wagons. Merari, who was carrying the much heavier load, had four covered wagons, and Gershon, who was carrying the fittings of the curtains and the curtainings themselves, but not the veils, had just two covered wagons. And they moved off immediately after the Judah set of tribes. And this was for a very good reason, because verse 21 points out that when the Kohathites, the other priestly, the other Levitical tribe, came with the holy things, the altars, the lava and so on, then the camp would already have reached its stopping place. Merari and Gershon families would have set up the outer curtains of the courtyard and would have been constructing the tabernacle so that the holy things could go immediately behind curtains, you see, and be set up, and Aaron and his sons could take off the wrappings so that no eye should see the holy thing. So it was organized with a view to both the practical and spiritual necessities of the case. So Judah and his tribes move off first. Then Merari and Gershon move off with the covered wagons, and they carry the outer fabric of the tents, as it were, Then you'll notice Reuben has beneath him the figure three. Reuben and his tribes move up next. Then Kohath, carrying the holy things on their shoulders, including the ark usually, but not in this case, as we shall see. And then finally, the tribes of Ephraim and his others, Benjamin, Manasseh, and last of all, Dan, Asher, and Naphtali. So that was the order in which the camp moved, and it was a very sound order. It started with praise, for that is the inner meaning of Judah. It's on this that the Apostle Paul plays in Romans chapter 1. Perhaps just to remind ourselves of the passage, because I was just about to quote it and I couldn't remember how it started. Let's have a look at it, because it is a very significant verse. Romans chapter 2, beg pardon. Romans 2, and verse 28. For he is not a Jew which is one outwardly, neither is that circumcision which is outward in the flesh. But he is a Jew, that's Judah, he is a Jew which is one inwardly. Circumcision is that of the heart. Remember, their heart was not right with God. This was the whole problem. Circumcision is that of the heart, in the spirit, not in the letter, whose praise, whose Jewishness, Judah, you see the connection, whose praise is not of men, but of God. Paul is actually quoting from Deuteronomy in that section, but it fits very well into our position here. So the cavalcade moves forward with praise, built into the very name of Judah. Now, on this particular occasion, we find verse 33, that they departed from the mount of the Lord 3 days' journey, and the ark of the covenant of the Lord went before them in the 3 days' journey to search out a resting place for them. Now, as far as we know, this was the only occasion that the ark actually went in front even of the cloud, to search out a resting place. Usually, it would be a little patch of blue right in the middle of the moving nation. Because of all the holy things, it was the only one that had an outer cloth covering of blue. What Moses says in Deuteronomy as the days of heaven upon earth. That was the significance of this journey. If only their hearts had been right with God, if only they had remembered the covenant. That was really what they were doing. They were heavenly people walking in the dryness of mankind. Well, they move forward, and verse 35, it came to pass when the ark set forward that Moses reminded the Lord of his covenants and of his great promises to scatter his enemies, and he said, "Rise up, Lord." Well, let's see what actually happened. Chapter 11. They've moved now for 3 days. They've moved from a place which is fertile, well-watered by God himself and by the frequent seasonal storms that fill the wadis with gushing waters, we read in Psalm 78. And now they move into the wilderness of Paran, which is very dry, very hot. It's early summer now, the second month. So it's somewhere around early June. And it really is hot. And the people complained. And it displeased the Lord. And the Lord heard it. And his anger was kindled. A lovely play on words here. You know, kindling is wood used for making a fire. It's a good old 16th, 17th century word. And it's that is actually now used. You see, the English version here, the authorized version, is lovely because it shows us that the Lord's anger is set on fire, and that becomes a physical fire in a corner of the camp. And some of the tents, the outer tents, were actually set on fire. The fire of the Lord burnt among them and consumed them that were in the uttermost parts of the camp. So it begins then with murmuring, and we learnt yesterday that if you murmur, you will die. I mean, this is a principle we learnt about holiness. If you murmur, you die. So that's exactly what happened. And then comes an exceptionally insightful verse. Look at it carefully. Verse 2. And the people cried unto Moses, and when Moses prayed to the Lord, the fire died down. Isn't it beautiful? The fire of the Lord comes out, begins to burn amongst the tents, going from tent to tent in this dry area. You can see the fire spreading. And Moses prays, and as he prays, you can visually see the result of his prayer. The fire dies down. That's the meaning of the word there. Was quenched. Now that is the power of prayer. In verse 4, same stopping place, despite this signal evidence from the Lord of his displeasure at murmuring, the mixed multitude, and this isn't the mixed multitude we meet in Exodus 12, for example, who joined the children of Israel. I think it's Wycliffe. And Tyndale as well, incidentally, who got this far in translating the Old Testament before he was strangled and burnt at the stake. They translated the common people. So it's the common people who fell a-lusting. And the children of Israel wept again. So they again start their complaining, their weeping. It's a word that keeps on coming. Verse 10, Moses heard the people weep. Middle of verse 13, they weep to me, saying, give us flesh to eat. Verse 18, the middle of the verse, say thou unto the people, sanctify yourselves against tomorrow, you will eat flesh, you have wept in the ears. And it continues through this chapter, this weeping, this moaning all the time. And it's very sad, you know, friends, just as you've experienced it. You've been in ecclesias where there is a sufficient number amongst the members to make even the going to the meeting on a Sunday morning sometimes something one, in a sense, dreads, because you know what's going to happen. You're going to have all these complaints about what the ABs are doing and so on and so forth. It does happen, doesn't it? And we are a mixed multitude. We've got to accept this fact. And it does make worship very difficult. Well, you can imagine how difficult it made Moses' worship. But he was steadfast, and his heart was right with God. He kept on praying. They say in verse 6, our soul is dried away. There's nothing at all except this manna. What a way to speak of angels' food, isn't it? Nothing but this manna. In verse 10, Moses heard the people weep throughout their families, every man in the door of his tent. You know, there's a chunter to each other, you know, to their next door neighbor. Ugh, another up there, you know. Oh, God. I'm sending little Johnny out for manna today. I'm just sick of this stuff. And once again, the anger of the Lord is kindled greatly. And the result is that Moses is troubled. If you look at modern versions, it isn't displeased. He is troubled. He's worried. Because the last time the Lord's anger was kindled, there was a great fire in the camp. Is it going to spread? And this time Moses doesn't wait for the people to come to him. Verse 11, immediately he falls in prayer to the Lord. And we now come to a very interesting matter. Brother John Helliwell yesterday spoke of how lovely it would be to be able to not only... He was talking about the problem of writing letters and how you can't get a tone of voice, an intonation of voice into a letter. You remember? And how lovely it would have been to be able to hear the Lord Jesus Christ himself. Now, I think there's a very good reason why, in fact, the immense and vast majority of God's people have never heard either the voice in the wilderness or the voice of the Lord Jesus Christ in New Testament times. It's because the way we look at the words will reveal our attitude to the speaker. You see, if you look now at verses 11 and 12, there are two very different ways of reading these verses. Moses said to the Lord, "Why have you afflicted your servant? Why haven't I found favor in your sight?" The emphasis in verse 12 is on the pronoun, I. Have I conceived this people? Have I begotten them? That you say to me, carry them in your bosom like a nursing father? Where can I find flesh to give all this people? And it could be a quite proper and dramatic reading of those words of Moses. A complaint to the Lord for the burden that he's thrust upon him. If you could read it that way, couldn't you? If you look at Deuteronomy chapter 1, verse 29, although not in the context of exactly the same incident, he's nevertheless using the same comparison between a father and his child. This is what we read. Moses now talking to the nation about 3 months before he died. Then I said to you, dread not, neither be afraid of them. The Lord your God, which goes before you, he will fight for you, according to all he did for you in Egypt before your eyes, and in the wilderness, where thou hast seen how that the Lord thy God bare thee as a man bears a son, in all the way that you went, until you came to this place. So that's the tone of voice in which the prayer was given. Moses was worried lest the anger of the Lord that had been greatly kindled could destroy the whole people. And so he comes with his distress for the people who weep. And he admits his incapacity to bear the people. and he asks for God, like a true father, to provide for these children of his. The question in verse 13 is one that's going to start gradually gathering echoes. Whence should I have flesh to give to all this people? Now, all this people, let's remind ourselves, verse 21. We're back in Numbers 11, verse 21. Moses said, "The people among whom I am are 600,000 footmen, and thou hast said, I will give them flesh that they may eat a whole month." 600,000 footmen. Now, is Moses being approximate? Because if you look at your chart, right at the bottom left-hand corner, we are given the actual number of footmen as 603,550. So is Moses really dealing in round numbers? Or is it possible that in that fire of verse 1 of this 11th chapter, actually 3,550 people died? Because the numbers of deaths are quite incredible. We shall see an occasion where 14,000 people died after one of these occasions of murmuring. You see, it is literally true. If you murmur, you will die. That's a principle of holiness. Well, we'll follow up that little echo in a moment. The Lord very graciously, and notice what he does. The Lord very graciously answers the prayer of Moses first before dealing with his great anger against the murmuring and weeping people. Very significant, isn't it? There are the people complaining about this manna that's becoming so loathsome to them. The Lord's anger is greatly kindled. Moses prays because he's so troubled at the situation. He admits, "I can't handle this, Lord. I don't quite know what to do." And it's that prayer that the Lord answers first. The people can wait, and the anger of the Lord is withheld. And this is another power of prayer, you know, brethren and sisters. It's not only the power that can affect the elements and a fire can be quenched with prayer, and this can happen in the spiritual sense within an ecclesia. We were talking about business meetings this morning, and sometimes they wax fairly hot. It's very sad, and it's true. And it would be wise sometimes if the presiding brother on such occasions would just stop the meeting and pray, and the fire gets quenched. It's worth trying. And the second element of the power of prayer is that God answers the genuine need and not the prayer of want. And sometimes we have to distinguish between the two. Sometimes our prayers are answered in the way we like or seemingly at all because we're praying for a want and not for a need. God's not interested in our wants in that respect. He knows we have need of these general things. All right. So, in verse 16, the Lord now deals with Moses' personal trouble. He says, "Gather me 70 men of the elders of Israel, and bring them unto the tabernacle, that they may stand with me there." And the 70 are elected or chosen in some way, and there seems to be an implication that there are probably six, and I say probably, it's only just a theory really, but there is a little bit of evidence for it, as we'll see. It looks as though probably six were chosen from each of the 12 tribes, which would give you 72. So that you have 70 elders then appear before the temple, the tabernacle itself. This is verse 24. Moses went out and told the people the words of the Lord, and gathered the 70 elders of the people, and set them round about the tabernacle. And in order to confirm that these 70 would in fact have his authority to help Moses bear the people, he, you notice, comes down, verse 25, in a cloud. So that the cloud moves, as it were, from the tabernacle proper to the door of the tabernacle, where the 70 elders are with Moses, and as it were, rests upon them and shows that his glory is associated with this new group of brethren who are responsible for helping Moses. And the Lord takes of the Spirit that was on Moses and gives it to the 70 elders. It's a lovely situation, isn't it? Where some of the Spirit that Moses has been given is presented to the 70 elders. It has parallels, obviously, in the New Testament situation, and it's that we are gradually moving towards, in fact, at this stage. It came to pass that when the Spirit rested upon them, they prophesied and did not cease. And that's an unfortunate translation, and any later version will give you a completely opposite statement. That in actual fact, the Spirit was taken, some of it from Moses, given to the 70 elders. They had it for a short time, and then it ceased. So, for example, the Septuagint reads, the Spirit rested upon them, they prophesied, and ceased. The Vice Standard Version. The Spirit rested upon them, they prophesied, but then they did so no more. And of course, the parallel with the New Testament is very useful and most exciting, because it does mean that the Spirit gifts were temporary, as we can see from this foundation of the concept of the Spirit being given to elders in order that they might work among the people of God. It was a temporary matter, and it ceased. And then verse 26, there remained two of the men in the camp. The name of the one was Eldad, the name of the other Medad. So perhaps there were 72 chosen, and two, of course, had to remain in the camp because there were only 70 to be elders. Now, this suggestion is based on the following words in the middle of verse 26. The Spirit rested on them. They were of them that were written, but they went not unto the tabernacle. So they must have been amongst the elders that were chosen as being worthy brethren as officers of the people, but because 70 was the number that was decided, two of them obviously had to remain in the camp, although they had been voted into the situation. And so verse 27, there ran a young man and told Moses, and said, Eldad and Medad, prophesying in the camp, Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of Moses, one of his young men, answered and said, my lord Moses, forbid them. And Moses said, enviest thou for my sake? Would God that all the Lord's people were prophets, and that the Lord would put his Spirit upon them. Now this has a lovely parallel in Luke chapter 9. Luke chapter 9. Verse 49. And John, one of the young men with Jesus, of course, answered and said, Master, we saw one casting out devils in thy name, and we forbade him, because he follows not after us. Joshua said, Eldad and Medad, prophesying in the camp, forbid them. And Jesus said, Forbid them not, for he that is not against us is for us. And verse 1 of chapter 10 of Luke, after these things the Lord appointed 70. Now why should this strange parallel exist? Well, we only have to look back to the beginning of chapter 9 of Luke's Gospel, the central portion of chapter 9 of Luke's Gospel. And Jesus, of course, has just been talking to Moses, because verses 28 and onwards recount the transfiguration. And there, in verse 30 of Luke 9, behold, there talked with Jesus two men, which were Moses and Elias, who appeared in glory and spoke of the exodus that Jesus would fulfill in Jerusalem. So it was, in fact, during this discussion, always beware of a brother who says, in fact. He's always going to spout a little theory. So I withdraw that remark. It may be that during this vital discussion for our Lord, between Moses, the man of God, and Elijah, the man of God, both who bore the people as a father has to bear a child, and found it exceeding heavy. Moses, responsible for the Exodus, and Elijah for that prophecy which Jesus was to fulfill in his living, and John the Baptist also. It is possible that amongst the things that they discussed was this very matter of how Jesus would extend his work in the short time available to him, and thus the selection of the 70. It's possible. Well, to return to the book of Numbers, because we must now move quickly to the end of this particular story. As we know, the Lord, having dealt with Moses' problem, and incidentally, one further point that comes out of Luke 10 is that when Jesus chose the 70, he had his little prayer as well. It's very much like, would God that all the Lord's people were prophets, because Jesus says, the laborers are few, wish that the Lord would send more laborers to the harvest. Do you remember? Comes in exactly the same context as the 70. So it's a parallel between the sayings of Moses and Jesus at that point. Returning then to Numbers 11, you'll remember that the Lord does provide them with flesh. He provides them with a meter high of quails all around the camp, and as Psalm 78 so well pointed out, the fat ones went out to have a very good game stew. But verse 33, while the flesh was yet between their teeth, ere it was chewed, the wrath of the Lord was kindled against the people with a very great plague, and forever after the name of the first place that the ecclesia of God stopped at after Sinai was the grave of the people who lusted. Frightening. We shall be looking at the next chapter tomorrow. Chapters 13 and 14 deal with the spies Deuteronomy tells us specifically that it was the people who asked Moses to send out spies to search the land, and that the Lord, therefore, in verse 1, is confirming the request of the people. And Moses himself says in Deuteronomy 1 that he went out, he operated this suggestion with considerable enthusiasm. So it started with the people, it was at the people's request, the Lord confirmed it, and Moses was happy to go ahead with it. But it led, of course, to the total rejection of a generation. Because, you see, in a sense, quite obviously, there is no point in searching out the land. Because if you pray, rise up and your enemies will be scattered, there's no point to go and look at the enemy, is there really? So that was very sad. And not only were the 10 spies immediately destroyed, chapter 14 and verse 37, even those men that did bring up the evil report upon the land died by a plague before the Lord, but Joshua and Caleb, which were of the men that went to search the land, lived still. Lovely, isn't it? So the 10 spies died immediately, but the rest of the people were to die during the next 38 years. Well, that has brought us to the real meat of what we're considering. What was the reaction of Moses? What was the prayer of Moses that has quenched fire, that has brought the Lord to organize a typical distribution of his spirit that was to be fulfilled at the beginning of the ecclesia, the worldwide ecclesia of the first century? What was the prayer that Moses prayed after this great disaster of the spies? Chapter 14, the Lord has threatened to destroy this people, to disinherit them, and to make a greater nation and a mightier than they from Moses himself, which would have been still a fulfillment of the promises, because Moses was a descendant of Abraham, so it was a perfectly possible thing for the Lord to do in righteousness. But what does Moses say? Verse 15. Now if thou shalt kill this people as one man, then the nations which have heard the fame of thee will speak, saying, this is Numbers 14, verse 16, because the Lord was not able to bring this people into the land, because the Lord didn't have the power, one of the great words of the book of the Epistle to the Romans, because the Lord was not able to bring this people into the land which he sware to them, therefore he has slain them in the wilderness. Now I beseech thee, let the power of my Lord be great, according as thou hast spoken. And he reminds the Lord of what the Lord had revealed to him in Exodus 34, the name of the Lord, long-suffering, great mercy, forgiving transgression and sin. And then verse 19, pardon, I beseech thee, the iniquity of this people, according to the greatness of thy mercy. And the Lord said, verse 20, I have pardoned according to thy word. Now, that's the point we've been trying to lead up to. It's the point that the Apostle Paul uses to describe the gospel that has come to us. that the power of God, the immense power of the Creator of the universe, the power of the one who raised the Lord Jesus from the dead, that power is most evident in forgiveness. For the gospel is the power of God for salvation to everyone that believes.